Hello, everyone, and thanks for listening and watching the Italian-American Entertainment Podcast. I'm your host, Vince Shirelli, and today we have the pair of Academy Award-winning composers of the two iconic songs from Dirty Dancing, Frankie Previtt and John DiNicola. Garnering an astonishing $55 million in sales worldwide, the Dirty Dancing original soundtrack spent 18 weeks at number one on the Billboard 200 album sales chart and 230 weeks in the top 30. As one of the greatest selling soundtracks of all time, the film became an iconic classic almost as soon as it hit the theaters in 1987. 33 years later, the Dirty Dancing brand is a cultural phenomenon. Welcome, Frankie. How are you?
Vince, thanks for having me. You know, it's always good to be here talking to another paisan.
There we go. And how I always start this show, since it is about Italian Americans, is before we get into all the good stuff about music and everything, where are you from now? But more importantly, where in Italy do you trace your ancestry?
I'm in Oceanport, New Jersey right now, which is about 5 miles from what I call the music capital of New Jersey, Asbury Park. Okay. And where I'm originally from, my parents, my father came over from Sicily at 4 years old. And I believe my mom is Nabladan. She was a Stella Teller. And so these two Italians met, and here I am talking to you.
Very cool. Well, it's great. You know, I, of course, knew of all the great Italian-Americans that were in the music industry. But, you know, every day I keep finding out more and more about all of us here in this country that did wonders in the music industry. So it's great.
Well, you know, I think it's part of the culture. I can remember being very, very young and my dad being an opera singer and always hearing, you know, these Italian notes going on in my house, and my uncles and cousins who were musicians, and going down to, I grew up in a town called New Brunswick, New Jersey. And you go down by the train station and you would hear my uncle singing with the window open, taking a voice class. Wow. And he would be serenading the whole neighborhood. So, you know, this is part of my upbringing and the seed that was inside of me that got watered by my parents and my relatives.
Very cool. So when did you start performing music and songwriting at the same? Did they happen, you know, simultaneously, or did you start playing first and then did the songwriting happen?
Now, songwriting came probably when I was like more like 15, 16, but when I was 10, my dad would, you know, teach me Italian songs because he was into Mario Lanza and Caruso. And so I would be singing Arrivederci Roma or A Love is a Many Splendored Thing. What was some of the other songs he would teach me? O Sole Mio in Italian.
Right.
Be My Love by Mario Lanza. And so I would be like a 10-year-old singing in front of a big crowd of people to raise money for a charity, not having a clue what I was singing. You know, at 10 years old, I was singing all these romantic songs. And then as I started to grow, 11, 12 years old, I started my own a cappella singing group. And so we would go down to the train station in New Brunswick because there was a long, long tunnel between the northbound and the southbound train, and it had the best reverb. And so we would go in there and we rehearse. We would do all these Frankie Lyman songs or Temptation songs. And, you know, people commuting would go by us and all of a sudden we have a crowd around us. And so, you know, having the adulation of doing something and people applauding and, you know, patting you on the back kind of encourages you to continue doing what you're doing. So for me, it started about 10 years old. And then I signed to a record label, London Records, at 15 years old.
Wow.
And my cousin, Joey Alessi, and I, there was a group or two singers called Don and Juan. They had a song called What's Your Name back in the 60s.
Okay.
And so we went in there and we sang this Don and Juan song. We just like walked into this guy's office and sang the song, and he gave us a record deal. So, you know, at 15 years old, I started recording, and then realized as time went on that you had to be a songwriter if you wanted to have any longevity.
Right. Yeah. No. It. That's what my grandfather was, an Italian musician, came from Sicily, and he owned his own record label here. And I'm in Rockford, Illinois, near Chicago. And he taught me the same thing from the beginning. I mean, he wrote probably 300 songs throughout his life, but most of the money he ever made was never with his own band, was writing songs for other people. So he taught me
that. I
know
the feeling.
Yeah. it's interesting, but you know, it's business too. So, now before we get into, you know, more of your life, with the songs you wrote in, you know, the '80s, of course, what was your biggest Italian American musical influence? Did you have like one specific Italian American that really influenced you?
Well, you know, starting out very young, you know, hearing Mario Lanza, he wasn't really an opera singer. He was more of a pop opera singer. So I heard a lot of his voice tonally, you know, obviously through genetics. I have that same tonal tenor sound as my dad when I hit that, you know, high C. And so I can hear my dad in me and his voice. So it's very, very reminiscent. Other people that I would listen to, I'm not even sure if half of them, I don't think many of them influenced me as much as a band called The Rascals.
Oh, sure.
In 1964. And that's when I knew that I had found the niche that I wanted to follow. And then it became like the Righteous Brothers, Bill Medley and Bobby Hatfield, those kind of blue-eyed soul singers, because I was hearing a lot of Italian notes, you know, those sure. real powerful notes, but I wasn't hearing the blue notes, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I kept searching for them. And when I heard the Rascals, it kind of like, well, I had the aha moment of who I wanted to be.
Wow. Well, and while you were chatting, it looks like your musical partner here jumped on. We have Mr. John.
No DiNicola. Way. Is DiNicola here? See, I can't go anywhere without him following me. Where is he?
How are you?
Hey, John, we need to see you, brother. I can't see you.
Oh, you can see me, can you know?
Ah, there you are.
I got to speak up. That's the only way you can see me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mr. Yeah. DiNicola. And we just got started. So since this is about Italian-Americans, we just found out about Frankie and where his family's from. But why don't you tell everybody where you're located now, but where in Italy you trace your ancestry?
Okay, well... we're in between New York City and upstate New York near Oneonta, Delhi area. We've been up here really since things went crazy in the city. Actually, we've been here since like February. And my son's in the city for the most part, although he came up for Thanksgiving. But genetically, okay, my dad, let's go with my mom's side first. She was... Barre.
Mm-hmm.
I think both her mother and father, so my grandparents were both from I think Pignola. No, sorry, scratch that. That's my dad's side. From a little town, Bedetto, I think, in Barre.
Okay.
And my dad's side, my grandfather was from, my grandmother was from Pignola, which is near, why am I blanking on this? If you basically go down, we visited a couple of years ago. It was wonderful. If you go down to Naples and a little south of that, I forget what the town is, and go straight up into the mountains. That's okay. Where Pignola is. The bigger town is escaping me right now, but it's a mountain town, and I had seen it in pictures from when my parents visited in the 70s. When we took a day trip down from Rome when I was there with my wife and my son and his girlfriend, and we took a ride up. It took about 3 hours to get there. Drove into the town, and it kind of looked like any normal little suburban town. Now it was straight up into the mountains, and I said, this doesn't look right. This is not what I'm remembering. And hardly anyone could speak English. And I was looking for my cousin, my grandmother's relative. Sabatelle was their last name. And we're looking at the map and we said, well, let's go up to where this church is. The church was at the very top of the mountain, right? So we drove towards that, and all of a sudden it was like going back 500 years. It was cobblestone, you know, going right around up to the church. Again, the church was the peak. And, you know, so we ended up tracking down a cousin, and we just had a splendid day there. It was
That's
wonderful.
Cool. That's so very cool.
Pignola, oh, I can't think of the town nearby. I'll get that for you before we finish.
No problem. So like we were just talking with Frankie before you came in, did you have a lot of influence from the Italian and Italian-American musical side growing up? Did that kind of catapult you into music at all?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, there was always music in my house for sure. My mom played piano by ear. She would just compose things and just play by ear. My dad was into audio back then. He'd have tapes and tape machines and always playing some music. There was a certain amount of Italian, Italian American singers. My dad wasn't a Sinatra fan. I'm not sure, exactly sure why, but there were some other, crooners that he liked. He always seemed to, you're talking about, let's see, when I was 1965, I was about 10 years old. So when I lived in a town called Amityville, New York, my dad was always, at that moment, that the whole Latin American craze was happening. Sure. So they had all these dance parties, and I was always going to sleep, and I just heard boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom, boom. You know, you hear the muffled bass while you're sleeping, and maybe that's why I ended up being a bass player. But so there was always music in the house. Italian, you know, here and there, but not as just influence from what they were playing.
Sure. It's interesting because, I was telling Frankie, I have an Italian band. I'm a musician and play Italian music, and my grandfather was an Italian musician, but even though we were Italian, my grandfather, and same thing like you were saying, even though I was, in the 90s, I was born, I still was brought up around a lot of that Latin-influenced bossa nova stuff. And
yeah,
so
exactly.
I fall more into the Latin side. So my band, we actually play our own little genre. We call it flamenco italiano. So we mesh the Italian and flamenco music. And so it's interesting. A lot of the Italians really loved that Latin bossa nova stuff back then.
It was a big deal back then. You remember, Frank. I mean, that was the big music of the day, the early 60s to the mid 60s.
Right, right.
Yeah.
We never knew the bossa nova.
Yeah.
That was Rosemary Clooney, I believe, who is also Italian.
Yep, exactly. So getting into your guys as a partnership, songwriting partnership, how did the two of you meet, and how did it turn into creating two timeless classics like I've Had the Time of My Life and Hungry Eyes?
Go ahead, Frank.
So I was in a band called Frankie and the Knockouts, which was going through a transition period. Yeah, the label had closed. Jimmy Einer was the president of that label, sold us to MCA, which decided MCA wanted us to sound like Night Ranger, which that wasn't going to really work for us. And so they dropped us. And so for 2 years, I was kind of trying to get another record deal, writing more songs to try to do a Frankie and the Knockouts fourth album. And I met a guy named David Prater, which had David had a little studio in his home. And really talented guy. Also, I believe a drummer and played some guitar and was a singer songwriter. And he started playing me tracks of other people that he was working with. And there was a track that he said, I got to play this track because I think it could be a really cool song. So he played me a song and I said, you know what? I really love the music and I'd like to try to write something to it. And he said, well, let me give the guy a call and see if he's open to do that. So he gave John a call and John said, yeah, go ahead, try to make a song out of it. And that piece of music was written, and that song was called Hungry Eyes. Yeah. And that was our very, very first song that we wrote together, was Hungry Eyes. And we continue to write. There's so many, John, I was listening to Voices Calling the other day, yeah. and all these songs that, you know, I haven't listened to in so long. And we have so many really good songs together. And we just continued to write until I finally got the call from that same Jimmy Einer, who shut his label and sounded me about writing a song for a little movie. And, you know, I pulled John into that, and that, you know, there's a whole story around that where Jimmy, I told him I didn't have time. You know, I was trying to get a record deal, and he goes, make time. This is going to change your life. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're going to change my life. All right. You kind of did that like 2 years ago. And so he goes, no, I got a, it's really a good little movie. And I said, well, what's the name of the movie? And he said, Dirty Dancing. And my hand went to my forehead, and I went, oh God, Jimmy's doing porn. You know, I'm thinking he's doing a porn flick. And he's, no, there's a good little movie. Johnny meets baby in the Catskills, and the father doesn't like the kid. That's all I knew of the movie. So I called John, and I said, the good news is we can write a song for this movie. The bad news is they want it for the last scene, and it has to be 7 minutes long. And I'm thinking, we got to write MacArthur Park, you know, we got to like write some epic song. So I gave John, you know, the idea of what was going on in the scene and what we had to do. And he came up with the track of Time of My Life, and sent me a track that he worked on with Donnie Markowitz. And I listened to it, and I played it over the phone to Jimmy, and he goes, you know what, I really like it. Why don't you make a song out of it? So on the way to the studio on the Garden State Parkway, exit 140, I take John's cassette and I stick it in the dashboard of my car, and I starts playing the music. And usually how I write a song is I jam to the music until I find the melody. And as I find the melody, phonetic sounds come out of me. So I'm listening going, I'm of my life, I'm of my life. You know, like, what the hell am I saying? And I'm scribbling Time of My Life on an envelope. And the rest of the song was written by the man upstairs, because either John or I knew what that movie was about. And little did we know that we had nailed it for them, because they had listened, as John always tells me. He goes, remember, we weren't asked to write for that movie. We were one of 150 people that wrote for that scene. So there was 149 people ahead of us. We were the 150th wow. song that they had gotten. And they filmed that a sequence. So they filmed the last scene first. Hmm. And so when I met Patrick Swayze at the Academy Awards, he was like, man, who wrote the song? Who sang the demo? And I said, what's going on? And he goes, you have no idea what this song did. And I said, well, tell me. He goes, we hated the movie. I go, what do you mean you hated the movie? He goes, we didn't have an ending song. You know, we had learned it to a cover song, and we were just going to go, you know, do the scene and let's get this movie over with. And then, you know, Emil Ardolino, the director, came in and wait, there's one more tape. And they played the song, and Eleanor Bergstein, who wrote Dirty Dancing, says, we got up out of our chairs and we started dancing. We were screaming. Everyone knew that was the song. And he goes, Patrick said, at the end of that day, that first day of filming, there was such a tremendous ending to the film that we like looked at each other and went, let's go make a movie. And he goes, we did a 180 on how we felt about the movie after that scene. So it was a connecting point for them. And like I said, the man upstairs wrote that song, because I would have never wrote that in a million years, because it wasn't in my pocket as an artist. Hmm. You know, Hungry Eyes, which I submitted later when they asked for more music, was more in the Frankie and the Knockouts pop rock kind of music. And, you know, all of this was inspired by what John gave me, you know, these tracks.
That's very interesting. So I always like ask, because I'm a songwriter, I always like asking other songwriters this question. And I have a bad habit of, if I don't, every time I write a song, if it takes me longer than 30 minutes, I scrap it. I don't ever come back to it.
Bad move.
I know. And I don't know why. If God forbid something happens to me one day and someone finds my iPhone, they're going to go through my voice memos and hear me humming a million different, you know, lines of melodies, and it'll be just a bunch of gibberish. But do you find that with a lot of people that, you know, it's got to be quick? Usually when things happen to me as a songwriter, it's very quick, but I always hear from everybody else that, you know, it takes this long process.
Well, I'd never keep my girlfriend if I was. So basically you got to realize that when you start to write something, and I say this to myself because the creative powers and forces that are inside of you come out sometime in little bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. And so if I say to myself, you know what, I got a bit of a verse, or I got a few lyrics for this chorus, and I feel myself not moving from that, I shut down and I revisit, you know, maybe the next day, and I play it. And if I get another little segment of it and I start to build it, and then more and more will come out of you when it's time for it to come out of you. And that's at least for me. If I force myself to stay there and I listen back, you know, the next day, it's a lot of dribble, you know?
Right. And
yeah. I don't know, but what about you, John?
Well, on the music side, I mean, it can come both ways, but I don't really give up on it. I mean, sometimes I'll give up on an idea, but as I've mentioned before with Hungry Eyes, that musically played itself down in 10, 15 minutes. I just sat at my Juno 106 keyboard and it just played itself. I knew I had an idea what I wanted to do, but it just, that one just, again, I'm not sure if anything's ever come that quickly. That's probably the quickest song ever, but for me. But other songs, like I'm working on some new material now. I just released my first record as an artist last year, and I'm working on the second one. And I've rewritten this one song 3 times now, and I'm finally liking it. I scrapped it. I said, I kind of finished it. And I said, that's not going to make it. And then I revisited it and broke it down and did it slower and, you know, took the chord changes and went a different direction and the melody. And now I like it. So it's anywhere in between too. I mean, it's a lot of times I'll put it, if it's not happening right away, I'll put it aside. And, honestly, an idea will come, and it's not other than, say, once in a while, like Hungry Eyes, where it's completed. A lot of times it's a piece musically, and I'll kind of put that down. I tend to, for the most part, I tend to, you know, like program it down so it starts to sound like a song right away. Sometimes I'll just pick up an acoustic guitar and play and finish a song that way musically. But most of the time I'll start looking for a drum beat. I'll put the drum beat down. I'll put a keyboard part so that it starts to sound like an early production. It starts to sound like something right away, because, you know, these days, modern music, there's a lot of production. You know, in the old days you could sit at a piano and just bang it out, but now it's like, has to have a sonic stamp, you know?
Interesting. Maybe I just have a bad habit. Usually what happens with me is I at least get a verse, chorus, do a, you know, a really rough recording. And then if I like that, I'll come back and do a bridge in a second verse sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I just have a bad habit of wanting to get it done quick, I guess. But
nice when it does come quick.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So did you guys know, I mean, was it, you know, like a Paul McCartney moment, like he's talked about before, where he just knew that it was going to be a giant hit? Did you guys know any songs you've written in the past? I mean, especially these two, did you have a feeling inside in your gut like, oh, holy crap, this is going to be, this is going to change my life? Or was it just another song to you guys?
You want to answer that, John?
Those two songs, well, you know, you're always going to put your best foot forward. You know, you're always going to hope that, you know, that whatever you do is going to take off and be something. Otherwise, you know, maybe you wouldn't be in the business and you wouldn't be doing it. But, you know, It's a good question. I think with the time of my life, we felt good about it. I felt good about it. You know, it was a small film production company. It wasn't like Columbia, you know, or, you know, Sony Pictures, or it was a very small company. It was a very small budget comparatively. So, but I guess, you know, you throw things up and you hope for the best. And we couldn't have hoped for a better situation than where those songs ended up. But, you know, I felt we had some good music going out there. Whether I, you know, did I think we'd be talking about it 33 years later? Probably not.
So for me, being that Hungry Eyes was the first piece of music that John and I composed, and every record label that I played it for turned it down, had no feeling of that, you know, I had a hit record, because everyone had turned it down already. And I was like, okay, well, they're not hearing what I'm hearing, and I think this could be a hit record, but, you know, I'm not the one that decides this. And time of my life, being that it was so long, the song, because it was written for that final scene, was a long shot for my brain to think that it could turn into being a single, you know, until it got edited down to like 4 and change, and it still was long to be a single. And so the music, Jimmy Einer had said to me after the song was in the movie, he says, either you're going to go to the Academy Awards or this is going to be a total flop. And I said, well, maybe there's some middle ground. He goes, no, that's it. That's it. So, you know, it was a long shot for both songs in my brain. But having, you know, somebody like Bill Medley and Jennifer Warren sing the song, and, you know, this was like my childhood, one of the people, the groups, the Righteous Brothers with Bobby Hatfield and Bill Medley. And so I was really honored to have that iconic voice on one of our songs, you know. And I was supposed to sing Hungry Eyes. They had asked me to sing it first. And then at the very last minute, 2 days before I was going in to record it, I got told that Eric Carmen was going to sing it. So Eric Carmen was produced by Jimmy Einer. Hey, how did that happen? And with a group called the Raspberries. And they blew me out without even telling me that I wasn't going to record it anymore. And Eric Carmen came in, and Eric had like a little bit of a problem. You know, he kept sending the track in, and they had filmed to our demos. So Time of My Life, Hungry Eyes were filmed to me singing Time of My Life with Rochelle Capelli, and then me singing Time of My, Hungry Eyes. So they, you know, everybody that was part of the film crew and the actors got demo-itis, I call it. They got so used to hearing the way we recorded it and the voices that were on it. So they kept on going back to Eric. Well, you know, Frankie did this little, can you do this over here? And he got a little ticked off. And so Jimmy called me and said, you know what, if I got to go out to Cleveland and see if I can work with him. And, you know, if I can't get him to do what the, you know, what we need, would you reconsider singing it? And I said, sure. And so I never heard back from him until I heard it in the movies with Eric Carmen singing it. Hmm. So, you know, the whole gist of this story is that the vehicle of this movie took these two pieces of music that John and I, Donnie was part of parcel of Time of My Life. John and I wrote Hungry Eyes. And the vehicle, the pieces, the sum of the whole. So Patrick Swayze, the movie, the song, Bill Medley, Jennifer Warren, Jennifer Grey. So if you take out one of those little pieces of the puzzle, you know, I don't think you have the same phenomenon. And so, you know, different song with this movie, you're not going to have that phenomenon. Probably two different actors, you're not going to have it. There was a heartthrob that happened. There was a time of innocence with how Jennifer Grey played her scene. So it all created this magical moment where the stars aligned, and it took our songs to become this Dirty Dancing phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even Eleanor would say the film company, they were thinking of going at first, going direct to video
Correct.
VHS, you know, that they, they, I don't know what turned it around. I think they just released it and it took off on its own. And
exactly, John. That's exactly what happened. They, because RCA had put the Time of My Life out like a month earlier, and they weren't in sync with the film company, and they were like, "Where's the movie? The song is out. It's on the AC charts. Oh, we moved it. Well, take your little movie and shove it." And so the movie came out, and it was going to go to DVD in 2 weeks. And within those first 2 weeks, 300,000 records got back ordered. And by the time RCA could print a record, 1 million records were back ordered. 55 million records later, we're talking to you.
That's crazy. That's amazing. And, you know, here's something crazy. I'm 30 years old. So this came out, you know, a few years before I was born. I've never seen the movie, actually. Never seen it all the way through. But
have you been under a rock? You're a rock somewhere?
I've seen bits and pieces when it comes up on AMC or something on the TV, but I've never watched the whole movie through. But, you know, for some reason, you know, especially I've had the time of my life, I'm 30 years old, but for some reason I get a memory of watching my parents' wedding video from 1988.
They probably played it. Yeah.
It's probably played in there, and for some reason I just have like this memory. So it's, even if you've never seen the movie, definitely those songs, you know, transcend.
Yeah. You're in for a treat if you go and watch it. It's a good movie. It holds up. You can watch it multiple times and still see it fresh. You know, it doesn't look like anybody's acting. It looks like they just caught some people, you know, going through something. So that's always a test, you know. Do they look like they're, you know, if two or three times, it's like,
yeah,
you don't look.
Well, you know, the movie grows on you instead of off of you, mm-hmm. you know. So as you watch it multiple times, instead of you being bored with it, knowing what's going to come on, you know, it grows on you, you know, because of all the elements that are in it, you know, and some of the old other music that's in it was, you know, really cleverly placed with these oldies and having Bill Medley be a singer from the 60s from that era to kind of thread the needle of the eras of 1987 back to 64. So it was cleverly done. And, you know, it connected. For whatever reason, and whatever they did and whatever we did, there's been a connection that the public, Joe Public, made this happen, not the machine.
Right.
It's true. Yeah,
it's very cool. So
Eleanor had written in a lot of these songs, and, you know, songs by, I'm talking about the old songs. I guess our songs are old now too, but the ones actually from the 60s. You know, Solomon Burke song, Otis Redding songs, and
Do You Love Me? All that stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. It all added up to, like what Frank said, a bunch of pieces coming together, acting, songs, heart, and a Romeo and Juliet theme, you know, so.
Still works.
Still works.
So Vince, something cool that John and I are doing on the December 18th, which I have to bring up to you, being that we're so entrenched here and talking Dirty Dancing.
Sure.
We got sounded by David Fischoff, who has a company called Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. Sure. And before the pandemic, he would bring all these like major rock and roll stars down to Florida, and you'd spend like anywhere from $2,500 to $5,000, and you'd spend a weekend with Roger Daltrey or, you know, Alice Cooper, whoever, and you'd write songs, you go in the studio, you jam with them. So now the pandemic hits, and so he has to go outside of the box and think of different ways to, you know, keep his company alive. So he decided to do it virtually. And so he's asked John and I to do a Dirty Dancing masterclass. So it's rockcamp.com/masterclass, and you can sit down and talk to John and I. John's going to have the multi-track of Time of My Life, the demo, and we're going to break it down, and you know, he'll show you the how the song was built and how it was recorded. And here's when we did this, and here's the bass line that we came up with, and, you know, ask questions about the song. And another really, really cool aspect of that masterclass is that Lisa Swayze will be with us.
Oh, cool.
So you're going to get the behind the scenes of Patrick and what went on and his feelings about building the movie and his thoughts, and how she is working with a charity that John and I also work with and are donating all the proceeds, John and I and Lisa, to the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network in honor of Patrick Swayze. So that's December 18th. And it's rockcamp.com/masterclass. So great. We'd love to see everybody there. It's for a great cause. And if you're a Dirty Dancing fan, it's a must see.
Well, that's, yeah, I'll definitely include the link on this. And that's great. My grandfather actually passed away of pancreatic cancer. So that's
sorry to hear that.
It's a great thing you guys are doing. And I wanted to ask you, too, about you have a new, something new going on with Hungry Eyes. Is that correct? Like a new version?
John does. Okay.
So what's that all about?
Oh, well, as I stated earlier, I decided after all these years, I was actually getting ready to do another song that Frank and I wrote that was in Avenging Angelo, a Sylvester Stallone movie. Well, they're Italian. it was sung by Steve Holy in the movie. It was called You're the Only One. But it was just in the movie. It was never released outside of the movie to radio or anything like that. And Frank and I always thought it was a really good song, worthy of perhaps getting another cover and getting it out there again. And I had just put in a new studio in my barn and I was trying it out. And I said, well, let me work on that song and try and get it to a point where I get another singer to come in and get it across. And the way I was hearing it in my head. And when it came time to find the singer, I just said, you know what, let me throw my voice down and see what happens. And people really responded well to it. And so I went through my whole catalog and ended up with 11 songs. The album was called The Why Because. It's on OMAD Records, OMADRecords.com is where you can find it, and all the usual Apple Music and Spotify. But when it came time to, I picked 11 songs through that I've written, and I was thinking, well, I can't leave Hungry Eyes off. I mean, I have to do it, but I scratched my head. How am I going to do that song? You know, it's an iconic song. Everybody knows it. And, you know, who am I to try and bring it out again? And I spoke with my son, who's a filmmaker, but also a drummer. And he gave me an idea to kind of do like a lot of indie rock bands now are drawing on the 80s synth pop thing. So he said, you know, they're drawn on like things like Hungry Eyes. So just make it like as an indie rock band would approach it. So I did that song in a kind of a new way, a different feel, different bass line, and changed some of the chords a little bit. And I kind of sing in a half falsetto, half full voice thing. And it's currently on the AC charts. Now it's like number 16 on the New Music Weekly charts. It had already gone on the Billboard chart, made it to 25. And at the same time, Frankie had a reissue of his song, One World. And we were both on the AC charts together 33 years later. And interesting Billboard, you know, noted that one of the articles they wrote about Hungry Eyes, my version, was that it was Dirty Dancing could be counted on, you know, 33 years later to still be spawning top 30 hits. So
that's very cool.
That's how that happened.
Yeah. So something that just came to my mind, it's kind of a two-part question, but first of all, what do you guys love so far in your career about being songwriters and musicians? But the second part just kind of came to me. It was a year ago, actually this week. It's crazy. It went so far, but it went so fast. But I was sitting with Peter Asher. So I'm a promoter as well. So I had Peter Asher here in Rockford last year, and I was talking to him, And he brought something up about, you know, how music is changing and, you know, we got to get all these rights for, you know, songwriters and copyright. He's big in all the copyright stuff. And he was like, you know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, you can be Britney Spears or whoever, and, you know, it's the songwriter that's making the money. He's like, look at us, you know, World Without Love was not written by Peter and Gordon. It's a Paul McCartney song. So we were talking about this, and, you know, he had a big career as a producer as well. And so it's interesting to me. That's why I want to ask you this. You're both musicians first. Did you ever regret or kind of wish that you were doubly in the spotlight with writing the song and being the performer? Or did you always have these years of thinking, you know, I was a musician first, you always wanted to be the rock star type of thing, and, you know, but it's still, you know, the songwriter makes all the money, so in the end it's still business. So it's kind of, I mean, so I don't know where the question's going, but I hope you kind of understand what I'm saying.
I think for me, my journey as a singer, you know, starting very, very young and then having record deals when I was young, 15, 16 years old, London Records. And, you know, then going to college and then getting another record deal with Capitol Records with a band called the Oxford Watch Band. I was always involved in being the singer songwriter. So I was fulfilling that dream. You know, then all of a sudden one day, after, you know, having top 10 hits with Sweetheart, with Frankie and the Knockouts, and Without You, and You're My Girl, back in 81 through 84, that journey ended. And there I was, you know, left out in the cold until Jimmy Einer called me again. And when he said, you know, Dirty Dancing, when we wrote the song, and asked me to sing Hungry Eyes, I thought, well, here's an opportunity again for me to be that singer-songwriter. And then it went to Eric Carmen. So there was a little bit of a letdown that, you know, I'm used to singing, you know, those songs. I was happy as hell, to tell you the truth, that Bill Medley, you know, and Jennifer Warren sang Time of My Life. But, you know, at the end, you know, knowing that Time of My Life and seeing where both songs ended up, I realized that's when I became a songwriter. You know, I was always a singer-songwriter and you know, looking at myself as an artist, and then I wasn't an artist and I became a songwriter. So the feeling with the success of it was a payoff, you know. Sure. Without the success, it would have been, oh man, I could have, oh well, geez, I wish I, you know, but that didn't happen. And so I was just ecstatic with the success. And again, I wrote a song that became bigger than me. As an artist,
right?
Yeah. You know, so that's really where I came from.
Yeah, you know, I was in bands, trying to get record deals. Sometimes I did a jazz fusion record on Motown Records, actually, that Erykah Badu ended up sampling something from it for her hit back in the day. But I was never a front man. I was never, you know, I was almost with Hall & Oates as their bass player and, you know, stuff like that. I actually auditioned for Frankie before I knew him as a bass player when he was looking for a bass player for Frankie and the Knockouts. I didn't audition, but I called in for it. So I didn't have those kind of expectations, really. So I have no complaints about where we ended up and becoming a songwriter. I started songwriting for the bands I was in trying to get record deals. But like Frankie said, you know, until you become a songwriter, you know, when it's not for yourself. And actually, all these years, I've always been trying to get into other people's heads. You know, when Frankie and I got into this position of being someone that they might look to get songs for artists, you know, you're always getting into that person's head. You know, what would Celine Dion want to sing? You know, what would Aretha Franklin want to sing? What, you know, and so you're always in that head. And that was what was kind of liberating when I decided to do my record. You know, I never aspired to be an artist. And in a way, I think that's liberating too, because I don't really give a hell what, you know, I'm happy when people hear the music, but that's not like my life depends on it. But the thing about this, you mentioned songwriters. I have to get my jab in. Songwriters are the low end of the totem pole now with
royalties.
With royalties. I mean, streaming doesn't pay songwriters. I mean, it pays like a thousandth of a penny. And I always, whenever we do these interviews, I always, you know, if you want to support an artist, don't go stream it on, I mean, stream it on Spotify, but go buy the CD or go buy the LP or do a download from iTunes. I think it's called Apple Music now. And I think they did away with iTunes, but you can still download a song. That gives a songwriter and the artist some money, but the streaming world is a bust for songwriters.
John, let me ask you a question. Now that you are a singer songwriter, right? Now, and you, I always thought you had a vibe when you sang. You used to send me these, you know, songs with a little scat melody here and there, and I'm saying, you know what? It sounds like Stevie Winwood meets Neil Young, you know, has that kind of a mesh to it, but it had its own thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was happy to hear that, you know, you put your voice on it and that you spread your wings that way. Yeah. And now that you've gotten a little bit of adulation from it and people enjoy it, does that make you feel differently about yourself?
That's a good question. Yeah, a little bit. I never was driven to be an upfront artist, you know?
Right.
So I still try and keep it, you know, I feel, yeah, kind of. It's like sometimes I get thrown a little in the spotlight with this now, and it feels a little funny. I mean, I don't absolutely love it, but I could probably get used to it, but it's more about, for me, it's like, and you know this too, Frank, you put this music out and you just want it to be heard, you know, really the bottom line is you want it to be heard and enjoyed. And that's why we do it. I mean, the idea that's it's falling on somebody's ears and they're being turned on by it. That's really great.
But think about how, you know, you and I are songwriters. And we are not record labels. We don't have the big machine behind us to put the $100,000 behind a single, you know? And all of a sudden, just the power of music took our songs and we're on the charts at the same time 33 years later because of the power of the music.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an interesting concept. I mean, you know, I guess, you know, it's out of your hands once you finished it, and you can only hope and pray. And then you put a couple of things, you know, on Facebook, or you put it, you know, you hire somebody to get you on the radio or whatever it is, but it's not a record label. We are not record labels. So it's really up to Joe Public to embrace us.
Right.
And somehow, you know, we got up to in the 20s, you know, on Billboard. So it's a pretty cool accomplishment 33 years later.
Yeah, it is.
It's very cool. And what you guys just said too rings through. I'll never forget what my grandfather told me. So he came to this country with nothing, started a record label, and then made some good money and would singer-songwriter, go down to Nashville, spent thousands of dollars on his old 45 records, you know. Nothing came out of it. Then one day he started getting into country music and went down to Nashville with a briefcase of songs. He barely spoke English and wrote, started writing country music as the Italian country boy. And somebody picked up his song and put it on the Hee Haw show. And that song is in the Country Music Hall of Fame. And he always told me, I tried for years by myself doing the Italian thing. Nothing happened. I wrote a country song as a joke, and it's the most money I ever made in music. And he's like, but you know what? I'm still happy because, like what John just said, that my music still is being heard by people, whether it's me singing it or somebody else. It's still making him happy. Yeah. And it's
what was the name of the song, Vince?
It's called Yesterday's Kisses. And he wrote it as a joke because he would go down to Nashville, and he actually became friends with Tex Ritter and all these guys, and because they thought he was the cute 4'11", you know, Italian guy. And he wrote a joke one night and made the song all half and whole notes. And he didn't really, yeah, it's a strange, it was just very elongated song. And one day he was a tailor, and he got a phone call from a radio station and said, is this Vincent Records? And he said, yes. And he said, listen to your song. It's a hit record. It's on the Hee Haw Show. And he's just like, what the heck just happened? So it's
with him singing it, or who sang it?
No, it was the backing group for the Hee Haw Show called the Town and Country Singers. Yeah. So
That got all that TV.
Yeah.
They had the show.
Exactly. So it's just interesting how things work out. But
situations, you know, that you have to be good, you have to be ready, and then you have to luck into a situation, really.
And sometimes, you know, it doesn't come around, but when it does, you said a key word, you have to be ready for when that opportunity comes.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people are, geez, you know, and I'm going to give up. And then all of a sudden an opportunity comes and you're not ready. You don't have the wherewithal to have the songs or continue to have the energy to want to do it. And the strong survive, you know, and you know, that's staying in the game, you know, unless you buy the lottery ticket, you don't have a chance to win.
Right.
Exactly. Right. Well, before we end this, it's the question I ask on all these podcasts, since this is about Italian American entertainment. What do you hope for the future of Italian Americans in the entertainment industry? And do you, you know, what in the time period you guys came from, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, there was a lot of, you know, you still had Frankie Valli and all those, the doo-wop stuff, still a lot of the Italian American, you know, nowadays you look and it's somewhat faded off because a lot of the immigration has stopped. So you're, you know, 3-4 generations deep into this. But, you know, like people like me playing at Italian festivals, trying to keep the heritage going is, I mean, do you have a good feeling that, you know, people like your kids or grandkids are going to continue the culture in this country?
I think that's it comes from people like you, you know, passing it on. You know, people like John and I passing it on and telling our stories and keeping it alive for the younger generation and having, you know, radio stations that still play, you know, the oldies and talk about it. I mean, half of the doo-wop music are Italians.
Right, yeah.
You know, so, you know, with movies that are made in the 50s and 60s and still, you know, using those sync licenses from those songs. And listen, 33 years later, Time of My Life is still in commercials, still being played in movies. And that's the power of having a hit song, is that, you know, your publisher can put it in a movie, can put it in a commercial and still let it live on. And that's what's going to continue to have not only Italian Americans, but good music. You know, there's a lot of good music written by a lot of really good people. Some of them just happen to be Italian.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's, you know, we're the big influx of Italians was the early 1900s into this country. And so, you know, we're talking going like 100 years now. So there's a bit of assimilation. And, you know, it may be a little harder to, I think, listen, Lady Gaga is Italian and everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. So, but does she, I don't know if she brings forward, you know, I don't know.
Her heritage.
It's underlying, yeah, but I mean, it's underlying in her singing approach. I mean, you know, there's stuff in there, but I do think the assimilation is going to slow any sort of, unless you're in the operatic world. Of course, that's a classical world. That's completely different. But in the
pop, but she'll do something with Tony Bennett,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, she's carrying the torch. She's handing the torch, you know, he's handing it to her.
Right.
And that's how it has to happen. yeah. is generation to generation passing the torch, you know?
Yeah. And I said this in an interview with somebody else before, what, as long as there's Olive Garden, unfortunately, there's Italian music. Italian music's going to keep going. As long as there's Olive Garden and mafia movies, I think the culture will still keep going. It's unfortunate that it has to be wedged into that stereotype of things, but what are you going to do? But I appreciate you guys' time. I will definitely include the link for Masterclass. That's December 18th, you said, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. I'll put that on this podcast, and I'll put some links to your the new version of Hungry Eyes, and then Frankie, we didn't really talk a lot about it, but One World. I know there's you have some stuff going on with that.
Yeah,
and,
that's a charity again that is for the Musicians Foundation, the Children's Fund, the First Responders Children's Foundation, and the NAACP, which are four charities that kind of cross. Thread and cross market each other. But the song One World was written in Russia with a blind Estonian, Sergei Manukian, Mick Targa, and this other American girl, Pamela Philip Olin, who wrote with Frank Sinatra, wrote many songs for Sinatra, Patti LaBelle, and Aretha Franklin. And so the four of us on a songwriting summit wrote this song, One World, that Earth, Wind, and Fire recorded and Columbia Records never released. And so 30 some years later, we wrote it in 1989, and we re-recorded it and tweaked it a little bit to work with the pandemic a little and with social injustice. And it's hopefully a song of healing. It's called One World. It's really, really a good song that hopefully I'm hoping that can pull us back together as a nation and realize we have to be in this together to win it.
Sure. Yeah, no. So I'll definitely include a link to that. Like I said, John, your new Hungry Eyes, and of course,
Hungry Eyes is killer. His version is killer. You gotta check it out.
And John, last night I was listening to some of your new stuff off your, what was it, last year you released that CD? You do. I like your voice. Like Frankie was saying, you have an interesting, I don't know how to describe it, but you have a great voice, but it's an interesting, I don't know.
It has a unique sound.
Yeah,
to
it's
it.
Very unique, and I like it. Yeah. So it sounds great.
I'm discovering it just like you guys are.
No, it's very it's very unique. I like it. So I'll definitely
One of the things that, you know, you talk about through the years is because I'm reinterpreting songs. One of the songs John Waite sang.
I was going to ask you about that. I had a show with John Waite in January this year.
Oh, so wow.
He's a great guy. So that was, yeah.
We're actually, we're revisiting, me and him, like five songs that we wrote back in the 90s. that he never put out. So he's re-recording some of those songs. But what I was getting to is, singing these songs, I kind of found my voice, which was fun. But you always hear about a quality, like I don't have a great voice. I can put my song across in a way that, you know, people seem to respond, but that's that thing you can't really, it's not trained. I don't have a trained voice. It's one of the things in the music business that you just can't, they're just not tangible. They just are there or they're not, so.
Yeah, but there's a lot of singers that have had, multi-platinum records. Mick Jagger's not the world's greatest singer, but his voice marries that music. And so when a voice can marry the track and it creates a sound, then you have a little bit of magic. And so you, in finding your voice, married it to your songwriting abilities and your tracks.
No, you could tell it's very authentic. It's not fake. You're not trying to be something you're not. So that's why I really enjoyed it. It's very unique.
And his version of Time of My Life is very unusually cool.
I liked it too. That's the one I listened to. It was very good. So I'll definitely put links to that so everybody, all our listeners can hear it. So once again, I appreciate you guys coming on. It was great talking to you. And congratulations on all your success. It's amazing. And hopefully, you know, in another 33 years, so still keep going.
Hopefully I'm here.
Yeah. All right. We didn't talk about pizza dolce and cannolis and chivalade. You probably, unless you're Barres, you don't know what chivalade is.
No, I don't know what that is.
You're not Barres either. If chivalade is a thin sausage, I think it has to be made. It's innate to Bari, and it's got cheese, and I think it's lamb maybe. It's the kind of sausage we know, that skinny sausage that's in a chivalade is particular to Bari, and not too many Italians know about it. It's kind of a very regional thing.
Interesting. Yeah, never heard of it. I'm Sicilian, yeah. So we have our own strange foods. but anyways, once again, appreciate you guys coming on. Thank you very much. I'll share the heck out of all your stuff, especially that masterclass coming up in a couple weeks. So
awesome. Thanks a lot, Paisan.
So, yep, once again, thank you, everybody, for listening to the Italian-American Entertainment Podcast, and tune in next time.